Mark Bauerlein is the best-selling author of The Dumbest Generation, one of the key works on the perils of the new social media. Bauerlein is a professor of English at Emory University, and his writing has appeared in many publications and scholarly periodicals, including The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, The San Francisco Chronicle, and The Chronicle of Higher Education. His new book is The Digital Divide, Writings for and Against Facebook, YouTube, Texting, and the Age of Social Networking. In it, Bauerlein collects essays by today's best thinkers and cultural commentators and adds an introduction that traces the development of the debate from the initial digital age zeal to a wave of skepticism and to a third stage of reflection that wavers between criticism and endorsement. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, the subtitle of the earlier book was How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, and then in parentheses, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. Now, the new book offers writings for and against social media. So have your views evolved since The Dumbest Generation?
Well, I certainly do continue to feel that digital tools pose an intellectual hazard for teenagers. Teenagers who simply spend too much time on Facebook, writing and receiving texts, going online, blogs, YouTube, and so on. And those minutes take away from minutes not only doing their homework, but leisure activities that help promote their intellectual growth, such as just reading books, going to museums, visiting historic sites, spending a little time practicing a musical instrument. All these things begin to deteriorate as the digital tools enter their lives in nearly a 24/7 fashion at this point. And because they're so mobile, they extend all the way into their bedrooms at 3 o'clock in the morning. I continue to hold that view. However, The Dumbest Generation was an entry into what at the time in 2008 was a rising public debate over the impact of digital tools, especially upon young people. And in those preceding years, we had so much hype, so much enthusiasm, and there was so much money to be made. And the convenience of these tools was extraordinary, and the access that they delivered seemed miraculous to people. And they are. But after all that hype, all those years of immersion, some of us began to see a downside, an intellectual downside to things. The loss of book reading time, the decline of newspapers, other things that contribute to the intellectual health of individuals and of societies. And we raised a skeptical side, some of us very harsh in our criticisms, but I think it was wise to regard our negative entry, our warnings, as really part of a general system of discussion, that it was good to launch a debate. It isn't good for everyone to believe the thesis of The Dumbest Generation. No, it is good for everyone to take the warnings in The Dumbest Generation and then weigh them against the benefits of digital tools and have a fuller debate, a larger reservoir from which to make judgments about how soon their children should get cell phones, how much time they should spend on Facebook, what kind of limitations they want to make on texting or of web browsing. And so when it came time after The Dumbest Generation came out and a few other books came out, such as The Shallows by Nicholas Carr and work by Andrew Keen and some other doubters about the digital age, let's bring the full debate together into one volume. We have some positive renditions, such as Stephen Johnson, who believes strongly in the benefits of the web, the cultural and intellectual benefits of the web, Clay Shirky on the positive side, and then you've got Nicholas Carr and Maggie Jackson, others on the skeptical side. Let's put them all together in one volume and let readers go back and forth and stage the debate here. That, I think, is where we should be right now. It's time to let the impact, I mean, we've reached a point where we're beyond the advent of all these web tools where we can get a little more reflective, a little less enthusiastic, and maybe a little less alarmist as well, and begin to reflect upon the last 15 years. I mean, we're getting farther and farther from the beginning of the digital age. Let's look at it a little historically. Let's bring in some writings from the 1990s and remember what people were saying then about the web. Let's bring the turn of the century when you had the big dot-com bust and what it meant for business on the web and how things started to turn more towards social uses of the web. And if we could string all those pluses and minuses together over a 15-year period, well, that might give us better judgments, a more broad and reflective perspective on the value of these tools. That's what I want this anthology to accomplish.
Now, your description of today's texting teen captures my own 15-year-old son, except that he's also a voracious reader. So I'm wondering if we're not selling these kids short.
I hope I'm selling young people short when I call them the dumbest generation. We want them to be smarter than we are or were at that age. We want them to be more knowledgeable, more skilled. We want them to surpass us. And so when you do a book chastising them for their intellectual habits or telling them, you don't know enough about history, you're too caught up in your social lives to realize there are bigger worlds beyond that you should care about. Well, that rebuke ought to be a constructive one. I mean, I'm a teacher, and so what I want to do when I rebuke students is to make them better. I don't want to put them down. I want them to take my criticisms as a challenge and to prove me wrong. So I often get letters, emails from young people. Some of them are rather angry, some four-letter words in there. But I respond to everyone, and we often get past the initial insult and move into substantive debate over different contentions in the book. And I like nothing better than to have to tell some bright 18-year-old who's written to me, okay, you're right about that one. You got me on that issue. I concede. That way, you feel like the book has done its job. The critical challenge has been answered, and we want them to answer that challenge by going out, reading more things, compiling more evidence, and demonstrating that we're wrong. And by the very virtue of the very fact of them doing it, they are invalidating the thesis that they are the dumbest generation. Now, about your son, you mentioned he texts, he's online, but he also reads like crazy. I think that's wonderful. And my attitude toward things is not YouTube in itself is dangerous. It is rather the balance issue, the zero-sum game that we have in the number of minutes available to young people in a day. I have a 6-year-old son. If I spend an hour of reading time with him, and then I have a half an hour, 45 minutes of sort of conversation time, and good conversation, not the conversation says, did you have fun at school today? No, you say, okay, what happened in school today? Asking him to give some response, some narration, some analysis, some why questions. If he does that, he can go watch a Pokemon video. He can go online and play some games or look at dinosaurs eating each other. That's fine. We want to set a balance issue here. The problem is that these tools are so compelling. It's so much fun to go and look at pictures that are posted from the party last weekend that the book, the newspaper, or the news on TV, a good radio show on NPR or C-SPAN. Again, these adult matters of good literature and history and politics and so on are simply crowded out. So what the tools do is amplify the social lives of these kids so much now, and they do average, according to Nielsen, 3,339 text messages per month. That's any teen with a cell phone, and about 85% of them have a mobile device of some kind on which they can text. More than 3,000 texts a month. Well, every one of those texts pulls time away from reading the newspaper, away from watching the news, or looking at old texts by Abraham Lincoln, or doing their homework, even. So it's the balance issue that is a problem. And what the tools do is make social life available to them when they are sitting in the back seat of their parents' SUV while they are driving on Route 40 in the middle of New Mexico. They can conduct their social lives in bed at midnight with the laptop open. There is no limit to these tools. I mean, that's the wonderful thing about them, but there is also a danger, especially in the hands of teenagers. So the point is not to take that cell phone away, no, or to close that Facebook page. No, the point is to maintain a critical mass of intellectual minutes, grown-up adult minutes in the day for your 17-year-old, where you pull them out of the 17-year-old's fear. You get them away from youth culture, from their friends, for a little while, and expose them to other worlds, other times, other people, other places. That is the goal, and it's harder and harder the more convenient these tools become.
And now another issue that you've raised before is pointing to some of these teens' inability to read nonverbal cues. You think that their use of this technology and these media is contributing to that. But I'm wondering, is that really so important to be able to read nonverbal cues, especially if we're in this networked virtual world where we may be, you know, communicating and doing business with and maybe even having relationships with people around the world that we actually have never even met in person?
It may be true that the world is becoming more mediated. Even the workplace is more mediated by the screen. More and more people work at home. More and more people work for themselves, start their own businesses, their own online activities. And in that regard, I think that being able to get out and do face-to-face contact and converse well and engage with people in a social and amiable way may not be as important as it used to be. But in many, many zones, it still is, certainly in the education world, for all the online education going on. Most education now is still face-to-face. In many professional zones, most activity is still face-to-face. I mean, lawyers have to engage with clients in all law enforcement areas. People have to interact with one another. They have to read each other in important ways. In any of the armed forces, this is crucial. The worry is that people don't realize that conversation, whether it is leisure conversation of people gathering for a lunch or professional conversation, say you walk into a job interview, is an art. It's something you have to learn how to do. You have to be able to look at people's faces, their expressions, their eye movements, their body language. It's a language, precisely, that you have to know how to read. And it's a huge part of human interaction, to be able to sense what someone else is feeling on the basis of their countenance, to look at someone and know things about that person simply based upon the tone of voice that one has. You lose a lot of those things through online interaction. If you don't spend a lot of time talking with people face-to-face, in particular talking with people far different from yourself, then you're going to have a hard time as a grown-up in many, many spheres of activity. Now, one thing that the tools do is in giving 15-year-olds the capacity to be in touch with other 15-year-olds at all times and in all places, they become so absorbed in their own age group that they end up suffering what social scientists have called age segregation. They spend so much time talking with one another, 15-year-olds talking to 15-year-olds, that their worldview, their idiom, their values, their expectations, their attitudes are so age-focused. When they step out, and on those rare occasions, have to talk to a 40-year-old, they don't have any basis for discussion. Their thoughts and ideas and their memories are so fixated upon their own age group that the 40-year-old comes off as just kind of a foreign creature. I don't know what to talk with that guy about. If you overhear the conversations of 15-year-olds, it's all about them and their friends. My goodness, you watch these reality shows on TV, dating shows, for instance, of 21-year-olds getting together for a blind date. All they can talk about is themselves and what they do with their friends. They do not talk about politics. They do not talk about religion. They don't talk about art. They don't talk about travel, unless it's traveling they did with their friends. It's their own personal experience of some kind. So life becomes very much focused around a social network. Well, what you find is when you get out of that social network, you have nothing to say. You've got nothing to offer. And that's going to hurt them when you go into the workplace, you go for a job interview somewhere, and they like you, and you go out to lunch with a few senior people in the firm, and over lunch the conversation flows, and they're 50 years old, you're 25 years old, and there is such a gulf because you don't have anything beyond your own social life that has really grabbed your attention. You're not a Civil War buff. You don't really care that much about any country in Europe that you visited. You studied the language, for instance. You can't call upon any art or music except pop music of your own age group. So you have no basis for discussion. You don't bring anything to the table. One of the things I tell students when they say, what do? I say, read the news, subscribe to a newspaper and read it every morning for 15, 20 minutes. You don't have to read the whole thing. Just skim through the headlines, read a few stories, and read the editorial page. After 3 months, you are going to find you've got a lot more to say. You've got some ideas and opinions in your head. You have a basis for discussion with people who aren't in your own age group, aren't in your own social sphere. It broadens you. It makes you comfortable with people not like yourself. And this is personal and intellectual growth. So this gets a little far afield from your question about interpersonal communication. But I think it applies when we look at the depth of involvement of young people. I mean, there's nothing wrong with texting. I mean, texting is very convenient. There is something wrong with 4,000 texts every month. It's just a quantity issue. There's nothing wrong with watching YouTube videos of Lady Gaga. There is something wrong with watching YouTube videos of Lady Gaga for 2 hours a day.
And that it's paradoxical because lack of relatedness or that lack of connectedness we see from people who are supposedly, the most connected and most involved with the social network. So, for example, the way that the movie The Social Network portrays the Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, is he the epitome of this kind of disconnectedness?
You know, it's interesting. I saw snippets of The Social Network, and whoever the actor was, he was mesmerizing as Zuckerberg. And part of it is he's a little bit odd. He doesn't relate well to other people, and yet, exactly, he creates the most social tool in human history. It is extraordinary how someone who seems to lack so many interpersonal skills should have understood so well what he could create that would make a lot of people want to join in. I saw one scene in which you have the contrast between Zuckerberg and the twins from Harvard. And the Harvard kids, the twins, wanted it to be a Harvard thing. They wanted a very elite, special, exclusive world. Zuckerberg said, no, no, no. This is nothing like what Facebook should be. We are going to make it something world-shaking.
Mm-hmm.
And he was right. He was right. I mean, the guy has some form of brilliance. And yet, would you want to be stuck in a foxhole or on a deserted island with Zuckerberg for a week and having to relate and to cooperate and depend on one another and survive or just discuss things? Ew. So, yeah, there is an irony there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a lot of research. Some have come out recently that says people who are hyper-connected in a social network have higher levels of empathy and higher, let's say, forms of tolerance or openness to others. I actually think that may certainly be true. But I do wonder that the deeper interpersonal capacities, such as not just saying, I'm interested in other people, but actually displaying behaviors of empathy, of being able to sit down with other people and taking a walk with them to talk about serious matters and not answer that cell phone when a call comes through. I just wonder if it's easy to be empathic. Or I should say, it's easy to say that you're empathic. It's easier to say how tolerant you are. We need more examination of what are the deeper friendships and commitments.
I suppose it needs to be tested in the real world. But one of your the essays in the book talks about our brains changing all the time, evolving, and perhaps that rate of change accelerating with these new technologies and modes of communication. But what if this is really neurological and like the character of Mark Zuckerberg in The Social Network? Maybe it's actually a form of generational autism. We might be seeing Generation A for Asperger's emerging.
Well, the brain is what people have realized in the last 20 or so years. The brain is much more plastic than people thought, and exposures of different kinds or sensations of different kinds do cultivate certain brain capacities, and non-exposure makes other brain capacities atrophy. So yes, we could say that the brain is becoming much more sensitized to visual stimuli than it was before, because so many things are more visual. We live in a much more visually oriented world than we did 50 years ago. I don't know where that's going. And I think it's hard to make predictions because the technology is changing so fast. Who in the world knows what people are going to be doing with technology in the year 2030? And if you take Facebook, Facebook started in, 2005, I believe, at Harvard. If you described Facebook to someone in 2002, well, there's this place where you can go make your own web page and put some pictures of yourself and you can make friends there, I think most people would kind of shrug their shoulders. Oh, yeah, that's fine. Sure, that's kind of interesting. Would anyone, if you describe Facebook, would anyone in 2002 have said, this is going to be a multi-billion dollar industry with 500 million users on it within a few years? Who could have predicted that?
And since you mentioned 2030, there is a science fiction book out now by Albert Brooks, who's best known, I guess, as a comedian and a movie actor and director, but he has a book out called 2030, and perhaps he's got some predictions for some of these things. Finally, I just wanted to ask you, I'm a member of the baby boomer generation, as I believe you are, and I'm just wondering if, you know, if quote unquote, we're the ones to talk, you know, given the state of the world that we're handing off to the next generation.
The baby boomers shouldn't boast of themselves. When I say the dumbest generation, they, kids today, are no less intelligent than I was, or maybe I should say I was just, and my cohort was just as adolescent and juvenile as adolescents are today. The difference was, I think, for baby boomers. So let's talk about the 60s generation, the 60s youth, the college students in the 1960s. They were rebellious. They were striking out for themselves. They were forming a youth movement, even. Now, the thing is, when they did this, they were critically engaged with the elders. Older people looked down on younger people as a bunch of rebellious kids who didn't have any respect, who didn't appreciate anything, who weren't patriotic, who didn't acknowledge all of the benefits of contemporary American society and economy. The youth at that time struck back. They were constantly criticizing the establishment. They were constantly criticizing the older generation. In other words, they were engaged. They were arguing back. And the generation gap of the 1960s, I believe, culturally, was a quite fruitful one. But the problem was, when the youth of the 1960s, the baby boomers, grew up, because they defined themselves as a youth movement, and because they aligned integrity with being young, and they regarded the elders as authoritarian and tyrannical and backward, when they got old, when the baby boomers hit their 40s and 50s and 60s, and assumed positions in which they had to become mentors or authority figures over the young, whether as teachers or parents or intellectuals or as journalists or anywhere else in which an older person renders a judgment of a younger person, they defaulted. They failed to act like mentors, elders, authority figures, because they didn't want to seem old. They didn't want to seem reactionary. They were formed in a world in which those were bad things. And so, why do we have so many young people today who are forsaking intellectual pursuits, who are so caught up in their social lives that they don't realize that there is the life of politics and society and art and culture that is a lot bigger than them and is more important than their own personal individual lives? They feel that way because the older generation has betrayed them. The older generation has not rebuked them. My colleagues do not, in the teaching profession, do not like a stern elder. They don't like a 50-year-old making judgments of the behaviors and attitudes of 17-year-olds. They just feel discomfort with that. They don't like to realize, I am going to become that old person that I despised 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And so they haven't given the young today a meaningful opposition. they haven't given the youth today something meaningful to rebel against. And so what are we stuck with? 17-year-olds who are indifferent to old people. And that is worse than respecting old people, and that is worse than disrespecting old people actively, critically, I mean, criticizing your parents. I don't like your world because this is what you created. Well, that could lead to a healthy exchange between old and young. Now, young people just tune out, they get on their cell phones, and they disregard the elders. And the elders will not act as, again, rigorous guides, critical mentors to the young.
Well, I hope it's not the ultimate rebuke of the previous generation, because when I engage my own children in various debates, they always point the finger back and say, you didn't seem to do so well, so I'm not really sure we've got much to learn about from you. And apparently they have their own ideas, so we can only hope.
Indeed. But Alan, keep trying. Keep engaging. keep it going. They will appreciate you when they're 30.
Very good. Well, thank you so much, Mark Bauerlein, author of The Dumbest Generation and editor of The Digital Divide, both available on audio at Tantor.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alan.